the Star Spangled Banner. The United States of America-National Anthem-should be referred to as the Divided States of America's Dream of War over Peace-Death over Life-Hate over Love-Lawlessness over Law Enforcement. This proof is all in the applied allegiances, the pledge, the oath, the duty, and the reality of a betrayal of the commons of our order of law. Image.png. The red, white, blue American flag with a very large tear from the top right to the bottom left. Torn by divided fights internal. Source, web link document URL, https://thefulcrum.us. Leveraging our differences. Article title, Why Are Kids Today Less Patriotic? Anthem begins in verse here, can we find a new promise? Or say why can't you see, by the evening's darkness from the light, what so dispirited we shunned at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and dull stars through the precarious fight. O'er the ramparts we watched were so wretched we be streaming. And the rocket's red glare, the bomb bursting in air, gave repudiation through the night that our flag was torn to tethers there. Oh say does that star-spangled banner yet wave? O'er the land of the slaves and the home of countless cowards adorned in fear. On the shore dimly seen through the mists of the deep. Where the foe's haughty host in dread silence reposes, what is that which the breeze, or the towering steep, as it fitfully blows, half conceals, half discloses? Now it catches a gleam of the morning's first beam, in full glory reflected now shines in the stream, 'tis the star-spangled banner dash, oh long may it wave.
O'er the land of the free and the home of the brave! And where is that band who so vauntingly swore that the havoc of war and the battle's confusion? A home and a country should leave us no more. Their blood has washed out their foul footsteps' pollution. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. And the star-spangled banner in triumph doth wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. Oh, thus be it ever when freemen shall stand between their lawful home and the war's desolation. Blessed with victory and peace may the heathen rescued land praise the power that hath made and preserved us a nation. Then conquer we must, when our cause it is just, and this be our motto dash in God is our trust, and the star-spangled banner in triumph shall wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. Image.png. The IACP, the International Association of Chiefs of Police.org. As the world's largest and most influential professional association for police leaders, is committed to advancing the safety of communities worldwide. Web link document URL, https://www.iacp, the International Association of Chiefs of Police.org. As the world's largest and most influential professional association for police leaders, is committed to advancing the safety of communities worldwide. /resources/oath-of-honor.
About the oath, the IACP governing body recently revised the IACP oath of honor to punctuate the importance of treating all individuals with dignity and respect and ensuring the preservation of human life. This important document is available in 5 languages.
Law enforcement oath of honor. On my honor, I will never betray my integrity, my character, or the public trust. I will always have the courage to hold myself and others accountable for our actions. I will always maintain the highest ethical standards and uphold the values of my community and the agency I serve. Shaping the future of the policing profession SM. This law enforcement oath of honor translated into Spanish.
Juramento de honor de las fuerzas del orden. Por mi honor, nunca traicionar mi integridad, mi carácter o la confianza pública. Siempre tendré el coraje de aguantar yo mismo y los demás responsables de nuestras acciones. Siempre mantendré la más alta ética, estándares y defender los valores de mi comunidad y la agencia a la que sirvo. Dando forma al futuro de la profesión policial SM.
Web link document URL, https://www.iacp, the International Association of Chiefs of Police.org. As the world's largest and most influential professional association for police leaders, is committed to advancing the safety of communities worldwide. /resources/oath-a-honor. Using the oath of honor. To be successful at enhancing integrity within an organization, leaders must ensure the oath is recited frequently and displayed throughout the organization, as well as ensure an ethical mentoring and role modeling are consistent, frequent, and visible. The oath of honor's brevity allows it to be constantly referred to and reinforced during conversations and ceremonies. Below are some suggestions. Recite the oath at all official police ceremonies and gatherings. Create posters of the oath and display in strategic and visible places, including police academies, briefing rooms, offices, and hallways, as well as public access areas. Have each academy class sign a large poster of the oath and display the signed copy. Print on the reverse side of officers' business/commission cards. Include the oath on training certificates and awards. Print the oath on department items such as coffee mugs, keychains, patches, pens. Refer to the oath when communicating with others. Use the oath as a backdrop in citizens' meetings and news media events.
Web link document URL, https://leginfo.legislature.ca.gov/fsslash/bill-client.xhtml?bill_id=20152016 AP630 & show amends equals false as amends the law today. As amends the law on 9/20/2015. Section 1. Section 1363 of the Government Code is amended to read, 1363. Unless otherwise provided, every oath of office certified by the officer before whom it was taken shall be filed within the time required as follows. 1. The oath of all officers whose authority is not limited to any particular county, in the office of the Secretary of State. 2. The oath of all officers elected or appointed for any county, and, except as provided in paragraph 4, of all officers whose duties are local, or whose residence in any particular county is prescribed by law, in the office of the county clerk of their respective counties. 3. Each judge of a superior court, the county clerk, the clerk of the court, the executive officer or court administrator of the superior court, and the recorder shall file a copy of his or her official oath, signed with his or her own proper signature, in the office of the Secretary of State as soon as he or she has taken and subscribed his or her oath. 4. The oath of all officers for any independent special district, as defined in section 56,034, in the office of the clerk or secretary of that district. B. 1. In its discretion, the Board of Supervisors of a county may require every elected or appointed officer or department head of that county who legally changes his or her name, delegated authority, or department, within 10 days from the date of the change, to file a new oath of office in the same manner as the original filing. The county may maintain a record of each person so required to file a new oath of office indicating whether or not the person has complied. Any record maintained pursuant to this paragraph is a public record subject to disclosure under the California Public Records Act, Chapter 3.5, commencing with Section 6250 of Division 7. 2. Notwithstanding any other law, including, but not limited to, Sections 1368 and 1369, failure of an elected or appointed officer or department head of a county to file a new oath of office required by the Board of Supervisors pursuant to this subdivision shall not be punishable as a crime. C. Every oath of office filed pursuant to this section with the Secretary of State shall include the expiration date of the officer's term of office, if any. In the case of an oath of office for an appointed officer, if there is no expiration date set forth in the oath, or the officer leaves office before the expiration date, the appointing authority shall report in writing to the Secretary of State the officer's date of departure from office. D. The powers of an appointed officer of a county are no longer granted upon the officer's departure from office. In its discretion, the Board of Supervisors of a county may require the appointing authority to rescind these powers in writing by filing a revocation in the same manner as the oath of office was filed. SEC. 2. Section 3105 of the Government Code is amended to read, 3105. A. The oath or affirmation of any disaster service worker of the state shall be filed as prescribed by State Personnel Board rule within 30 days of the date on which it is taken and subscribed. B. The oath or affirmation of any disaster service worker of any county shall be filed in the office of the county clerk of the county or in the official department personnel file of the county employee who is designated as a disaster service worker. C. The oath or affirmation of any disaster service worker of any city shall be filed in the office of the city clerk of the city. D. The oath or affirmation of any disaster service worker of any other public agency, including any district, shall be filed with any officer or employee of the agency that may be designated by the agency. E. 1. In its discretion, the Board of Supervisors of a county may require every disaster service worker of that county who legally changes his or her name, within 10 days from the date of the change, to file a new oath or affirmation in the same manner as the original filing. The county may maintain a record of each person so required to file a new oath of office indicating whether or not the person has complied. Any record maintained pursuant to this paragraph is a public record subject to disclosure under the California Public Records Act, Chapter 3.5, commencing with Section 6215 of Division 7. 2. Notwithstanding any other law, including, but not limited to, Sections 3108 and 3109, failure of a disaster service worker to file a new oath of office required by the Board of Supervisors pursuant to this subdivision shall not be punishable as a crime. F. The oath or affirmation of any disaster service worker may be destroyed without duplication 5 years after the termination of the disaster service worker's service or, in the case of a public employee, 5 years after the termination of the employee's employment. SEC. 3. Section 24102 of the Government Code is amended to read, 24102. A. An appointee shall not attach deputy until, 1. A written appointment by the deputy's principal is filed with the county clerk. 2. A copy of the appointment is filed with the county auditor, if the auditor has so requested. 3. The deputy has taken the oath of office. B. In its discretion, the Board of Supervisors of a county may require every appointed deputy of that county who legally changes his or her name, delegated authority, or department, within 10 days from the date of the change, to file a new appointment in the same manner as the original filing. The county may maintain a record of each person so required to file a new oath of office indicating whether or not the person has complied. Any record maintained pursuant to this subdivision is a public record subject to disclosure under the California Public Records Act, Chapter 3.5, commencing with Section 6215 of Division 7 of Title 1. C. A revocation of the appointment of any deputy shall be made and filed in the same manner as the appointment. D. 5 years after the date of revocation of appointment of a deputy, the written oath of office subscribed to by such deputy may be destroyed and no reproduction thereof need be made or preserved. SEC. 4. No reimbursement is required by this Act pursuant to Section 6 of Article 13B of the California Constitution because the only costs that may be incurred by a local agency or school district will be incurred because this Act creates a new crime or infraction, eliminates a crime or infraction, or changes the penalty for a crime or infraction, within the meaning of Section 17,556 of the Government Code, or changes the definition of a crime within the meaning of Section 6 of Article 13B of the California Constitution.
Info, web link document URL, https://claremontrevywaffbooks.com/-the-natural-law-a-or-and-peace/. Spring 2018 Essays. On the Natural Law of War and Peace. A Guide for Statesmen and Warriors. By Angelo M. Codevilla. Image.gif image.gif. The Way of an Eagle in the Air. The Way of a Serpent upon a Rock. The Way of a Ship in the Midst of the Sea. And the Way of a Man with a Maid. Proverbs 30:19. In order to understand what guidance natural law gives us about war and peace in our time, it is first necessary to have some understanding of what natural law is. Far from being a hazy concept peculiar to some philosophers, natural law is quite simply how the world works. It is reality. Our very civilization is based on understanding that nature and man exist and behave according to laws that our minds can grasp by observation and study. Only recently has it become customary to distinguish between facts and values, that is, between what is and what we want. Formerly, the fundamental distinction was between truth, reality, and opinions, the thoughts we know to understand reality. The people who built the United States believed that attention to the laws of nature and of nature's God was the key to thriving because they knew that ignoring or flattening reality does not turn out well. Physics and chemistry remind us that natural law is inflexible and self-enforcing. You may identify as a bird, eat bird food, and wear feathers. But if you jump off a cliff chirping and flopping those feathers, Mother Nature's laws regarding mass and motion will punish you. Nor will she let you make salt out of two sodium atoms, regardless of your commitment. Plants are just as subject to laws, regardless of anybody's opinion. Apples, oranges, and avocados require different conditions to thrive. That is why judgments about farming have to be right by nature, or else. Not so long ago, the Soviet government, following a scientific consensus that acquired characteristics are inherited, wasted millions of tons of seeds trying to modify wheat to grow in Siberia. In America today, scientific consensus is that the globe is warming, and yet citrus growers are moving their operations southward because the trees don't share that consensus. Mother Nature does not care what anybody thinks. Wild animals are, as the saying goes, hardwired to survive and thrive, moving and reproducing to take optimal advantage of weather and food sources. They can't help doing the right things for themselves. So far as we know, human beings are the only part of creation capable of doing the wrong things for themselves. But that freedom doesn't affect nature's peculiar requirements for human beings to survive and thrive. Human survival, like that of other mammals, starts with food and community. But the happiness of these creatures, who are more than animals but less than gods, requires more. User's Manual. The Ten Commandments are the most common and concise compendium of natural law regarding man. But aren't they, one might object, a set of peculiarly Jewish ideas that draw their authority from the claim that Moses received them from God? Think again. Chart a verse in each of the commandments, and ask how humans would fare living by the reverse list, have many gods and disrespect them all. Never stop to rest or to consider whence you came or whither you go. Dishonor your father and your mother. Kill as you please. Take what you can from whomever you can. Fornicate with whomever you can. Lie and betray. Envy and scheme against those around you. Not even criminal gangs could survive on that basis. Nor could any individual be happy who lived by such counsels. At best, he might become a tyrant. His choice would be whether to die like Stalin or like so. Aski, we are forced to conclude that, whatever their provenance, the Ten Commandments just happen to be a pretty good summation of what nature requires for human beings to live human lives. Moses' precepts concerning magic, sodomy, and much else, also invite us to consider the consequences of violating them. But the point here is not that the Torah is the apex of natural law about man. Aristotle, Cicero, and many others have delved into the subject systematically and more deeply. Rather, the point is that our civilization is full of pretty accurate descriptions of what happens when humans disregard Mother Nature. In fact, all actions can only be understood in light of their natural consequences. Naturally, all voluntary movement aims at some state of rest. We move, walk, speak or shut up, for certain purposes. When an action aims at a purpose other than, or even opposite to, what may reasonably be expected from it, the effort is wasted at best, or counterproductive. All actions make sense insofar as they serve their proper ends. As the saying goes, not even a dog wags his tail for nothing. Human action follows the same logic. The farmer fixes the tractor to till the ground, to grow the crops, to help maintain family and country. This is what philosophers mean by teleology. What is the natural law concerning trades or professions? They are naturally about producing certain things. Yes, all of them bring advantages to the tradesman. Yet, by nature, each is about producing a good peculiar to itself, buildings that stand, ships that float, plumbing that doesn't leak, shoes that fit and last, medicine that heals, banks to serve lenders and borrowers. When human activities aim at results other than the ones proper to them, nature makes humans suffer the consequences. Trades exercised primarily for the tradesman's profit tend to produce buildings that fall down, ships that leak or capsize, shoes that chafe and fall apart, financial systems that defraud. That is why human activity cannot be understood in terms of power-seeking or pleasure-seeking as ends in themselves. Consider the successful tyrant. He can have anything he wants, including all sorts of things that are bad for him. The same goes for very rich people. Dictators and rock stars routinely make themselves powerful and miserable. Powerful men differ from powerless ones in the number of people they make miserable. If they do well, it is not because they have the power to please themselves but because they learn what really is good. What, then, should we expect from statesmen and warriors? Why peace? Over the past century, as American power has grown, the American people's peace and security have diminished. Even though America's armed forces have won essentially all their battles, Americans have enjoyed peace for only about 30 of the past 100 years. Common sense tells us that winning battles naturally leads to winning wars, and hence to earning peace and security. Results so contrary to common sense and intentions do not happen because of errors in policy. They happen only from mistakes regarding first principles, regarding the natural laws of war and peace. Just as nature obliges shoemakers and shipwrights to produce certain goods, so it obliges statesmen to produce certain results. What are the goods or natural ends of statesmanship? The Chinese Empire's millennial claim to rule has been to provide Tiananmen, heavenly peace. Caesar Augustus' claim to the power that replaced Rome's raucous republic was that he was the princeps pacis, the prince of peace. As the Roman Empire was fallen, St. Augustine defined statesmanship for the next 1,000 years in terms of tranquillitas ordinis, the tranquility of order. The temporal ruler was to be the defensa pacis, the defender of the peace. 1,400 years later, Abraham Lincoln summarized his objective as peace among ourselves and with all nations. Niccolo Machiavelli and Thomas Hobbes were, if anything, more insistent on judging any exercise of statesmanship by the degree of peace that it produces, especially internal peace. Indeed, just as peace seems to be the natural end of statesmanship, the incapacity to rest from war really does seem to be the punishment Mother Nature imposes for incompetent statesmanship. If peace is so essential to well-being, why then is mankind so often at war? Simply because, by nature, each of us wants his own way. We human beings share in Eve's appetites and in Adam's responsibility. Individually and collectively, we want to be a law unto ourselves. Statecraft is the art of reconciling all sides' claims to their own desires, and perhaps to their own peace. We fight wars so that we may have our version of peace. That is why any peace is what one side earns for itself by defeating the other side's attempt to get the peace it wants. Still, although war is the most intense of activities, it aims naturally at a state of rest, neither more nor less than any other activity. Law of war. This is why approaching war is anything other than the pursuit of peace is naturally self-defeating. Consider how two of history's greatest warriors failed. During the Second Punic War, Hannibal subordinated strategic logic to operational logic by staying on the offensive even after having failed to break Rome or force it to negotiate. Napoleon never thought of an end to his string of battlefield victories. His failure to aim at peace nullified his valor as a warrior. As Charles de Gaulle wrote, Napoleon broke France's sword by striking it unceasingly. Hannibal's and Napoleon's victories in battle contributed to defeat in war because the victories were not aimed intelligently at war's natural objective, an end to the fighting. Victory in war means forcing the enemy to acquiesce to one's enjoyment of one's own peace. Aristotle noted that such peace is the natural end of the statesman's art and victory the natural objective of the warrior. Fact is, your victory is what makes possible your peace. Victory, of course, comes in different forms, everything from the enemy's annihilation or enslavement, as was the rule in ancient warfare, to sovereignty over border provinces, as was common in 18th-century European warfare. But victory in all its forms means the vanquished no longer disturbs the winner's enjoyment of his peace. But to establish and maintain one's own peace naturally presupposes a coherent understanding of that peace. If you have made war, killed and destroyed, and yet you cannot enjoy peace, it means that you have been fighting the wrong battles, killing the wrong people. During the past 100 years, American statecraft has not produced peace because progressive politicians of both parties, beginning with Woodrow Wilson, Charles Evans Hughes, Herbert Hoover, and Franklin Roosevelt, have pursued concepts of peace that are literally outside the realm of possibility. Indeed, the enemies these statesmen designated were purely creatures of their own minds, whether autocracy, war itself, world disorder, or ancient evils, ancient ills. Who would we have had to kill in order to defeat those enemies? Hence, for a century, American blood and treasure has been committed to kill and destroy certain people as if they embodied the abstractions in our leaders' own minds. But who are the people whose death would end war itself, bring about world order, establish a liberal democracy, and ancient evils, reconcile historic enemies? The conjuring of unreal enemies makes it impossible to ask who might be the real persons who actually trouble our peace, whose killing or constraint would restore it. This unnatural understanding of what troubles our peace is the reason why America's military campaigns have been waged without reasonable plans for achieving peace. Unnatural objectives lead to unnatural operations. Since Korea in 1950, the U.S. government has explicitly disavowed seeking military victories. The old way versus the new way. Understanding this 100-year divorce of force from purpose requires looking again at the argument between Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. Trail, who advocated the big state, rejoiced in America's emergence as a great power because he believed that the U.S. could and should use this power to secure Americans' enjoyment of domestic peace and tranquility. Like George Washington, who he called the best of great men and the greatest of good men, T.R. wanted to mind America's business, as, in Washington's words, our interest guided by justicial counsel. He regarded power as a means of keeping trouble away from America. The enemy was whoever troubled America's peace. War was a temporary measure to secure that peace. By contrast, Wilson had started his career denouncing the hurdles that America's founders had placed in the way of forceful human improvement. He believed that enemy at home and abroad was anything and everything that stood in the way of his vision of progress. For him, America itself existed to defeat such enemies. To improve America, he pushed prohibition, which started a war at home. To improve the world, he invented the League of Nations. For him, Washington's and the Gospels' admonition to mind one's own imperfections, looking not for specks in others' eyes, was priggishness. When senators asked him how his commitment to everlasting peace differed from a commitment to perpetual war, he was unable to answer. Wilson erased the distinction between war and peace. American statesmen have yet to redraw it. In short, the peace at which Teddy Roosevelt aimed was America's peace, to be secured by minding America's business, that is, by speaking softly to foreigners and carrying a stick big enough to bash whoever would interfere with us. George Washington, John Quincy Adams, and T.R. had taken for granted that America's business came first, always, and that this business requires jealous attention to squaring ends with means. Words had to be smaller than the stick. Wilson, however, collapsed the distinction between America's business and everybody else's business. Voicing limitless objectives, he gave little if any thought to how America's armed forces could actually achieve them. The American people rejected Wilson. Yet he won the hearts and minds of the subsequent century statesmen. Read in Charles Evans Hughes, Herbert Hoover, Franklin Roosevelt, Dean Acheson, John F. Kennedy, Henry Kissinger, George H. W. Bush, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, we might imagine that the world had united in disarming and outlawing war, or in eliminating ancient evils, ancient ills, that it was policing the world through the UN, that nothing could stand in the way of freedom, that satisfying the Soviet Union attained it, that a new world order was born in, that democracy was conquering the Middle East, or that Islam was terrorism's solution. None of this was true. Although most of these men were not shy about sending Americans to fight abroad, none explained how doing so could realize the marvelous vistas they sketched. From Washington to Trail, American statesmen have known that the world is made up of different folks who want incompatible things. That is why the essence of statecraft is jealous attention to what our own power can do to secure our own interests. But because men from Wilson's time to our own have been certain that all civilized peoples share the same objectives of peace and progress, they have felt justified in dispensing with the essence of statecraft. That is why, far from producing peace, the past 100 years' efforts have got us less peace and more war. Nature's penalties. Each departure from the essence of statesmanship has earned the penalties imposed on unnatural behavior. Let us see what truths nature has been trying to teach us. In 1921, Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes brokered 3 major treaties that scrapped more naval tonnage than all of history's wars had ever sunk, and fixed the major powers' ratios of naval power. Japan also agreed to respect China's integrity and sovereignty in exchange for America's promise not to fortify our Pacific bases. America disempowered itself from securing that objective. Our best and brightest believe that the treaty secured peace because they were sure that all peoples shared their consensus that armaments cause war. Hence, their logic said, limit the means of war and you will limit the will to war. That was not true. In fact, the natural chain of logic leads in the opposite direction, from ends to means. That is why these treaties secured not peace but Japan's supremacy in the Western Pacific, China's dismemberment, Pearl Harbor, Corregidor, and so on. Herbert Hoover believed that the world had outlawed war by the 1929 Kellogg-Briand Pact. That was not true. Franklin Roosevelt spent the first 7 years of his presidency lecturing in America and the world about the need to act as if it were. His lasting legacy was to fight World War II while trying to persuade the American people that Stalin understood good and evil in the same way Americans do. That was not true either. Naturally, because untruths necessarily cause confusion, they produce divisions among Americans. These divisions plague us to this day. FDR, and especially Dean Acheson and Harry Truman, fostered the consensus that, finally, the United Nations had brought law and order to international affairs. So precious was that consensus dash and dash illusion that in order to preserve it they sent some 50,000 Americans to die in Korea in what they called a police action. Naturally, that sacrifice resulted in preserving an enemy that today targets nuclear weapons on America. Douglas MacArthur protested, in war, there is no substitute for victory. The rule of consensus, deny nature, deem MacArthur a dinosaur. Under Presidents John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Richard Nixon the practice of defeating global evils by committing U.S. military forces without intending to defeat the enemy became explicit. JFK redeemed his promise to bear any burden in freedom's defense, presumably against the Soviet Union, by sending Americans to fight in Vietnam. Johnson identified the enemy as poverty, ignorance, and disease. He, Kennedy, and Nixon were unanimous that military victory in Vietnam was impossible, perhaps because they stipulated that U.S. efforts there must not unduly upset the Soviet Union. In the service of such illusions, they rotated some 12 million Americans in and out of Southeast Asia. Some 58,000 never came home. Ho Chi Minh and the Soviets had other ideas more in tune with nature. So did the North Vietnamese soldier who drove his tank through the U.S. Embassy gate in Saigon in 1975 as U.S. Marines were beating doomed allies off the last helicopter escaping from the roof. Unnatural consensus. The same unnatural consensus spoke through Kissinger and Nixon to the effect that nuclear weapons had sobered the Soviet Politburo. All America had to do for the Soviets to join in Wilson's dream of world order was to make U.S. nuclear forces incapable of targeting the Soviet military or of interfering with Soviet missiles targeted on America. Accordingly, the U.S. government built strategic forces fit for killing Soviet civilians rather than for protecting Americans in case of war. The Soviets would follow suit. In 1972, Kissinger, presenting to the Senate the treaties that embodied this vision, spoke of having banished nuclear war. 8 years later, Harold Brown, Jimmy Carter's Secretary of Defense, had to tell America that the Soviets' preparations to fight, survive, and win a nuclear war were well advanced. Those who pay attention to natural law, you see, build things to do themselves some good. Dogs do not wag tails for nothing. American politicians do. As the Soviet monster was dying of disaffection, the first President Bush tried to save it by massive transfusions of U.S. cash and untied loans, never repaid. He also told the crowd in Ukraine's capital that they should be good Soviet citizens. Drafted by Condoleezza Rice, this speech was the voice of the U.S. establishment, which valued the dream of a U.S.-Soviet cooperation over the real prospect of undoing a real enemy. Ukrainians shook their heads in disbelief. The same president and consensus decided that since Saddam Hussein's Iraq had violated world order by absorbing Kuwait, the U.S. would conduct a police action to re-establish the borders. At the time, Saddam was no enemy of America. 500 years earlier, Machiavelli had cautioned that people ought to be caressed or extinguished. President Bush just assumed that a new world order would follow his unfinished war. Instead, by harming Saddam without eliminating him, he helped make him the Middle East paladin of anti-Americanism. The troops Bush then stationed on Saudi soil to deal with this newly menacing Middle East ended up energizing Muslim jihad against America. George W. Bush and Barack Obama differed only verbally and quantitatively in their approach to this jihad. Essentially, each ordered the U.S. armed forces to do the same things they had done in Vietnam, hunt down groups and individuals, while the rest of the government infuses these societies with economic aid and social reform. They did so while explicitly eschewing any plans for ending the conflict, never mind winning it. With various degrees of emphasis, each bent ever backwards the counter-suggestions that the Muslims who attack America do so for reasons related to Islam. In fact, neither would identify any causes of any-American terrorism. Bush's proposal for the Department of Homeland Security stated that terrorism will be with us indefinitely because of modernity itself. Obama's use of the term violent extremism moved further into abstraction. But the blood of hundreds of innocents and the fears of millions are not abstract. Natural resentment. Ordinary Americans' desire to live peacefully is natural. So is resentment of a consensus that has no plan for delivering peace. Though the establishment has become shy of voice and support for more nation-building or engagement with moderate local allies, it cannot imagine anything other than what it has been doing. Thus the question must be asked, what has it been missing? What has Mother Nature been trying to teach us about how to deal with war so as to obtain peace? The lessons are neither new nor complex. They will startle only those whose intellectual horizon is the same old consensus. First, foreign relations involve dealing with foreigners, that is, people whose cultures, priorities, and interests are their own, not ours, above all, whose business is their own. The sine qua non of peace is to recognize different people's natural, ineluctable focus on themselves, and then distinguish what is our business from what is their business. Others may not like what we do in pursuit of our own business. They are less likely to forgive intrusions into theirs. By nature as well, statesmen are their people's fiduciaries. Minding the business of one's own nation is a test that stretches the capacity of the very finest statesman. Just as it is impossible to serve two masters, it is impossible to serve more than one nation at a time. Nor is the attempt to do so legitimate. John Quincy Adams rightly reproved suggestions that the U.S. help one side or another in conflicts within or among foreign peoples by asking who appointed as judges in their causes. By nature, they alone get to decide what they want for themselves. Second, by that very nature, we alone get to decide how important anything is to us and what to do about it. Because we alone are responsible for ourselves, decisions about how to mind such business as we decide is our own come first, while foreigners' needs, desires, and views are naturally incidental. Like everybody else, we are the only ones on whom we can count to defend our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Hence, alliances are subject to the same rule of nature's bank loans. The more you need them, the less they avail you. In short, nature seems to dictate that we must make only such commitments as we can and intend to keep with our own resources no matter what. Even questioning whether our own interests should come first is unnatural. Third, earning the respect necessary for living peacefully as we please requires fulfilling commitments, and especially dealing harshly with whoever disrespects us. Respect is the practical meaning of honor in international affairs. It is hard-earned and easily lost. Words bigger than actions, dropping allies in their hour of need, responding to injuries with complaints rather than with disproportionate recompense, are the most common ways in which modern America's leaders have dishonored their country. How precious honor is may be seen in a 1791 memo from Alexander Hamilton to President George Washington on how to respond to Britain's possible movement of troops across U.S. territory to attack former U.S. ally Spain and New Orleans. The disasters of war with Britain at stake, Hamilton outlined the ways in which Washington could ignore or color Britain's affront. But he ended by counseling that, were Britain's transit to have violated America's honor, disasters would have to be suffered for the sake of that honor. In fact, nations exist only insofar as they're honored, especially by their own people. Fourth, while America's armed forces are in more honor perhaps than any in history, our leaders' failure to draw peace from their victories has drawn down the reservoir of respect for America among foreigners and, most importantly, among Americans as well. The consensus, from Henry Kissinger on down, blames the American people for insufficient support of the elite's long-range policies and for isolationism. But the discrepancy between the declared objectives, the sacrifices, and the results has been impossible to hide. Actions in Korea, Vietnam, and the Middle East make sense only to those few thoroughly trained to suppress ordinary human beings' natural revulsion. Ordinary Americans' revulsion at their own government is no small tragedy. Fifth, and finally, our experiences with nature tell us that those old simpletons George Washington, John Quincy Adams, Abraham Lincoln, and Teddy Roosevelt were right. Don't go looking for trouble and make nice with everybody. As Jean Kirkpatrick reminded her fellow neoconservatives, there is no inherent or historical imperative for the U.S. government to seek or achieve any other goal, however great, except as it is mandated by the Constitution or adopted by the people through elected officials. By nature, no society exists to conduct foreign policy. Rather, foreign policy naturally exists to allow the society to live in peace. But if you have to fight to preserve or reestablish your peace, then fight with all you've got to accomplish this as quickly as possible. Partial commitments, sending signals, or shows of force, convey stupidity and invite contempt. Yes, all wars are foggy and require adjustments. But nature supplies a compass by which to navigate the fog. Its needle keeps pointing straight to the reason you fought in the first place, your understanding of the peace you are seeking. The path to that peace is victory. Angelo M. Codevilla, 1943-2021, was a senior fellow of the Claremont Institute and professor emeritus of international relations at Boston University. He received his B.A. Bachelor of Arts degree from Rutgers University, 7. Web link document URL, https://claremontrevwafbooks.com/out/angelo-m-codevilla/. Author, Angelo M. Codevilla. Angelo M. Codevilla, 1943-2021, was a senior fellow of the Claremont Institute and professor emeritus of international relations at Boston University. He received his B.A. Bachelor of Arts degree from Rutgers University, and M.A. Master's of Arts degree from Notre Dame University, and his Ph.D. in Security Studies, U.S. Foreign Policy, and Political Theory from the Claremont Graduate School. At Boston University from 1995, Professor Codevilla was a U.S. Naval officer, an assistant professor at the Grove City College and North Dakota State College, a U.S. Foreign Service officer, and a member of President-elect Reagan's transition teams within the U.S. Department of State. He dealt with Western Europe and with matters affecting the U.S. intelligence community. He served as a U.S. Senate staff member dealing with oversight of the intelligence services, a professorial lecturer at Georgetown University, and a senior research fellow for the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. On Amazon.com, The Character of Nations, How Politics Makes Embrace Prosperity, Family, and Civility, by Angelo Codevilla, 2000. Between the Alps and a Hard Place, by Angelo Codevilla, 2000. The Prince, by Niccolò Machiavelli, translated by Angelo Codevilla, 1995. Informing Statecraft, Intelligence for New Century, by Angelo Codevilla, 1992. Arms Control Delusion, by Malcolm Wallop and Angelo Codevilla, 1987. While Others Build, A Common Sense Approach to the Strategic Defense Initiative, by Angelo Codevilla, 1988. War, Ends and Means, by Paul Seabury and Angelo Codevilla, 1988. Modern France, by Angelo Codevilla, 1974. Articles by Angelo M. Codevilla. The Election to End All Elections. The Election to End All Elections. Trump, imperfect as he is like a finger in a dock that, if removed, would loose a deluge. The Election to End All Elections. The Election to End All Elections. Millenarian Mobs. Millenarian Mobs. An Old and Dangerous Story. The Original Fascist. The Original Fascist. From Movement to Epithet. What's Russia to Us? What's Russia to Us? Up from Russophobia. Defending the Nation. Defending the Nation. Why We Need Nationalism, Now More Than Ever.
Weblink document URL. https://www.police1.com/police-jobs-and-careers/article/addressing-cops-confusion-over-the-public-duty-doctrine-sdnvxwandhqaxosalash. Steve Pappy, Pappenfuss Training to Think Addressing Cops Confusion Over the Public Duty Doctrine. Proper training on the principles of the public duty doctrine and how it applies to police officers is essential to avoid liability on the part of the department and officers. January 5, 2012 co-authored with Eric P. Daigle. The so-called public duty doctrine provides that absent a special relationship between the governmental entity and the injured individual, the governmental entity will not be liable for injury to an individual. The governmental entity owes a duty to the public in general. The doctrine has been commonly described by the oxymoron, duty to all, duty to none. 1. The concept of duty establishes a great moral obligation in those who have taken an oath to serve and to protect the public. Officers are instilled with the principles of honor, integrity, and selflessness. As a result of these basic principles, officers often feel required to take action in certain situations when taking no action may actually be the best course of action. Often, officers believe that they have a legal obligation to act above and beyond what is actually required of them. Law enforcement professionals' lack of understanding of the legal principles of the public duty doctrine often leads to inappropriate actions on the part of the officer. In addition, the fear of liability for failure to act, and the personal code of honor that many sworn public servants hold, influences their decision to take action at all costs to protect and defend life and property. While this desire to serve the public is commendable, police officers must understand that they have no obligation to protect any one individual unless a special relationship exists. Rather, an officer's sworn duty is to the general public. Confusion and conflict. As a general rule, an individual has no duty to come to the aid of another. A person who has not created, by his words or deeds, a danger to another, is not liable for failure to take affirmative action to assist or protect another unless there is some relationship between them which gives rise to a duty to act. To the application of these general principles in the area of law enforcement and other police activities has produced some confusion and conflict. The confusion is further exacerbated by widely held misconceptions concerning the duty owed by police to individual members of the general public. 3. By becoming a police officer, an individual does not give up his right to the protection of these general principles. A police officer does not assume any greater obligation to others individually. The only additional duty undertaken by accepting employment as a police officer is the duty owed to the public at large. For following these general principles, California courts have found no duty of care and have denied liability for injuries caused by the failure of police personnel to respond to requests for assistance, the failure to investigate properly, or the failure to investigate at all, where the police had not induced reliance on a promise, express or implied, that they would provide protection. 5. The concept of a lack of any special duty owed to any individual member of society who is in need of assistance often flies in the face of law enforcement professionals who have taken an oath of office to protect and defend. The oath of office for law enforcement officers, however, as required by the California Constitution, does not mandate duty to an individual. 6. Rather, the oath cites the support and defense of the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of California against all enemies foreign and domestic. 7. In our nature to help. While neither the California Constitution's oath of office, nor the International Association of Chiefs of Police Model Oath of Honor 8, suggest that officers have duties other than the support and defense of the Constitution, and the maintenance of character, integrity, and public trust, no officer wants to see innocent individuals victimized or suffer harm of any sort. One duty-dilemma issue, for example, may be the concern of contracting a fatal disease from performing CPR on a subject. Indeed, this is a real concern as just this past March, a deputy in Florida died 5 years after having contracted a virus while conducting CPR on an infant. 9 officers must discern the pros and cons of taking action in such a case to balance this unlikely tragic outcome against the more likely heartbreaking consequence of failing to act in a timely manner. An officer's misconception of his duty owed to the individual, however, may cause that officer to believe he has no choice but to provide assistance in the matter. While the officer is under no legal obligation to render aid to any one individual, once that officer decides to render aid to a victim, a special relationship may be established that produces a duty to an individual. Examples from case law. Federal and state case law provide, for example, that a police officer's failure, upon stopping an automobile, to advise the passenger to leave the vehicle and find other transportation was not an actionable breach of duty to the passenger. 10. An officer owed no duty of care to a tow truck driver struck by a passing vehicle while working an accident scene because the officer did not create or increase the risk of harm that led to the injuries. 11. No duty existed where a police officer, upon responding to a disturbance, confiscated a gun that was later returned to the individual through department procedure and was used sometime thereafter to shoot the complainant, because the initial seizure of the weapon did not establish a special relationship with complainant that would continue indefinitely. 12. A police officer owed no duty to order an accident victim who had sustained a spinal injury not to leave the scene. 13. Police officers who recognized an assailant as a likely perpetrator of a prior assault, and conducted surveillance of assailant in the laundromat in which the victim was present, did not establish a special relationship between the officers and the victim to impose a duty on the officers to protect the victim from the assailant. 14. A police officer, who stopped a motorcyclist for speeding but did not perform field sobriety test, had no legal duty to use due care to recognize signs of intoxication and prevent the motorcyclist from continuing to drive, and therefore, was not liable when the driver was involved in an accident 10 minutes later. 15. Courts typically find that no duty has been established and deny recovery for injuries caused by the failure of police personnel to respond to requests for assistance, the failure to investigate properly, or the failure to investigate at all, where the police had not induced reliance on a promise, express or implied, that they would provide protection. 16. For example, a plaintiff was unable to establish a duty on behalf of police when police failed to respond to a plea for assistance 40-5 minutes before a homicide. 17. The courts, however, have found that police officers may create a special relationship with individuals in certain circumstances, thereby establishing a duty of care to that individual. This special relationship may be created when an officer performs an affirmative act which places a person in peril or increases the risk of harm. For example, an officer who investigated an accident and instructed an individual to follow him to the middle of the intersection, where the individual was hit by another car, established a duty of care for that person. 18. A highway patrol officer established a duty to an individual when he parked his vehicle with lights engaged behind the stalled motorist, but later left the scene without warning the motorist who had relied upon his protection and was struck by another car. 19. Departmental policy. Some departments have internal policies that stipulate the circumstances in which a special relationship may exist. The San Jose, California Police Department's policy for rendering first aid, for example, states that officers who have begun rendering aid have created a special relationship with a victim and now have a duty to continue providing care unless one or more of the following conditions is present. 1. The scene becomes unsafe. 2. The officer is too physically exhausted to continue. 3. The officer is relieved by someone of same or higher medical authority, or 4. The victim revives to any a source of confusion for some officers may be that while federal law is clear that there is no liability for failure to act when no special relationship exists between law enforcement and an individual, some liability may exist in certain situations where the state legislature enacts laws mandating an officer's duty to take action. 211 Such state-mandated duty to an individual arises in the area of domestic violence. Throughout the country for many years, officers failed to take seriously the dangers of family violence. As a result, states enacted legislation mandating special provisions and protections for victims of child and spousal abuse. 22 As further documented in the California Commission on Peace Officer Standards and Training Domestic Violence Workbook 23, these requirements include that officers shall make every reasonable effort to identify the dominant aggressor, shall complete a report in all domestic violence cases, and shall take custody of any firearm or deadly weapon in plain sight. A solemn pledge. While legislated exceptions to the public duty doctrine exist, the officer must still understand that in only certain circumstances will he be exposed to liability for failure to act. This misunderstanding can lead an officer to take inappropriate action which violates an individual's constitutional rights and could ultimately lead to litigation against the officer and the department. Law enforcement personnel are moral and honorable public servants. Most sworn officers take their oaths of office as a solemn pledge, a pledge to safeguard life and property. Officers lose their lives every day attempting to fulfill this oath. Officers, however, often put themselves at risk because they incorrectly believe that they have a duty to act when, in fact, no such duty exists. Officers must balance the pros and cons of taking action against the rights, responsibilities, and the limitations of the profession imposed upon them by the Constitution, statute, and case law. Proper training on the principles of the public duty doctrine and how it applies to police officers is essential to avoid liability on the part of the department and officers. The training should include a full and comprehensive review of the exceptions to this doctrine and any statutory requirements to act or protect individuals, as well as those situations in which, through an officer's actions or omissions, create a special relationship resulting in a duty to persons. References. 1 Glover, D. 2006. Public Duty Doctrine in State Tort Claims Act Cases. Retrieved March 20, 2011 from Teague and Glover. Page number, a website, web link document URL, http://www.aguianglover.com/mdias/public_duty_doctrine_state_tort_claims_acct_cases.pdf. 2rest.2dtorts, paragraph 314. For Witkin, Summary of Cal. Law, 8th ed. Torts, paragraph 554, p. 2821. 3 Williams v. State of California, 34 Cal. 3 D. 18, 1983. 4 id. 5 id. 6 California Constitution, Article XX, paragraph 3 provides, in pertinent part, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of California against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of California. That I take this obligation freely, without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion. And that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties upon which I am about to enter. 7 id. 8 the I. A. C. P. Oath of Honor format provides, on my honor, I will never betray my badge, my integrity, my character, or the public trust. I will always have the courage to hold myself and others accountable for our actions. I will always uphold the Constitution, my community, and the agency I serve. Weblink document URL, http://www.iacp.org. As the world's largest and most influential professional association for police leaders, is committed to advancing the safety of communities worldwide. /Police/Executive/Professional Assistance/Ethics/Artist/Law Enforcement/Honor/Debit/150/Default.asks. 9 Weiner, J. 2011. Orange County deputy dies from illness he caught trying to save infant, sheriff's office says. The Palm Beach Post News. Weblink document URL, http://www.palmbeachpost.com/orange-county-deputy-dies-from-illness-he-caught-1,327,335. HTML. Sort equals desk, retrieved 03/20/11. Tensity of Sunnyvale v. Superior Court, 203 CAL.app.3D 839, 1988. 11 Minch. California Highway Patrol, 140 CAL.app.4TH 895, 2006. 12 Baker v. City of Los Angeles, 188 CAL.app.3D 902, 1986. 13 Camp v. State of California, 184 CAL.app.4TH 967, 2010. 14 Davidson v. City of Westminster, 649 page number, 2nd, 894, 1982. 15 Huckle v. City of San Diego, 179 CAL.app.3D 520, 1986. D. 16 Williams v. State of California, 34 CAL.3D at 25. 17 Hartzler v. City of San Jose, 46 CAL.app.3D 872, 1975. 18 McCorkle v. Los Angeles, 449 page number, 2nd, 453, 1969. 19 Mann v. State, 70 CAL.app.3D 773, 1977. 20 San Jose Police Department, 2008. Peace Officer First Aid and CPR Guide. San Jose, California, 21 Cal. Gov. Code paragraph 815.6, mandatory duty of public entity to protect against particular kinds of injuries. See also, Avery, M., Rudofsky, D., Bloom, K., 2008. Police Misconduct Law and Litigation, 3rd ed. Egan, Minnesota, Thompson Reuters/West. 22 Cal. Penal Code paragraph 11166, K. 23 California Commission on Peace Officer Standards and Training. 2006. Domestic Violence, 5.2 ed. Sacramento, California, about Eric P. Daigle. Attorney Daigle practices civil litigation in federal and state court, with an emphasis on defending municipalities and public officials. He focuses civil rights actions, including police misconduct litigation and employment actions, as well as premises and general tort liability cases. Mr. Daigle acts as legal advisor to police departments in the state of Connecticut and outside the state, providing legal advice to law enforcement command staff and officers in the areas of legal liability, policy drafting, employment issues, use of force, laws of arrest and search and seizure. His experience focuses on officers' use of force, specifically in the training, investigation and supervision of force and deadly force incidents involving law enforcement. He currently serves as a member of the Oakland, California Independent Monitoring Team and works with law enforcement agencies that are under investigation or under a consent decree by the Department of Justice Civil Rights Litigation Section. Attorney Daigle is the general counsel for FBI-LEADA and the New England Tactical Officers Association. He is a former member of the Connecticut State Police and currently maintains his certification as a reserve officer. About the author, Steve Pappy, Pappenfuss is the CEO of Battalion Defense, which distributes Premier Armor, armor carriers, ballistic helmets and shields, and other tactical kit. Pappy retired as a sergeant after serving 29 years with the San Jose, California Police Department. During his career, he worked patrol, field training, FTO, street crimes, SWAT, auto theft, sexual assaults, narcotics, family violence, and supervised the department's in-dash service training division. He holds a force analysis certification from the Force Science Research Center and is a certified instructor with the California Commission on Peace Officers Standards and Training, POST, in several disciplines including firearms, defensive tactics, baton, force options, and emergency vehicle operations, EVAC. In addition to running battalion defense and teaching both academy recruits and in-dash service officers, Pepe provides expert witness consultation in police practices, use of force, and training issues. Contact Steve Pepinfuss.